interrupt all the fascinating conversations going on, but we need to resume the meeting. We've reached item number 4, hatchery and fishery reform policy briefing, and we have the team from the hatcheries division, Heather Bartlett, our manager. Welcome. Haven't seen you in a little while.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Director Anderson and Deputy Director Storr, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Heather Bartlett, and with me today is Christina Iverson, and I'd like to introduce to you Brian Misseldine, who we hired recently to replace James Dixon's position. He leads the Hatchery Evaluation and Assessment Team Unit and will be actively involved in hatchery reform.
Hey, welcome.
The presentation today is going to basically be an update for the Commission relative to the Fish and Wildlife Commission policy C-3619. We'll start the presentation with a recap of the work done and the presentations provided in 2011, and then go over the watershed plans, broodstock management standards, the environmental standards that are captured in the Commission policy, a summary, and then lay out the objectives for this upcoming year for the department. So in late 2010, actually it was December 2010, and then January 2011 and February 2011, department staff provided a series of presentations to the Commission about the Washington State hatchery system. We covered the historical context and the legal basis for the system. It's been around for well over 100 years. There's language captured in state statutes for hatcheries to be used as mitigation for fishways and habitat alterations, and then also there are some state court proceedings or cases that have identified hatchery fish are included when you think about sharing and management of the resource relative to the state and the tribes. Then we also had a presentation that we covered the contemporary production and economic value. Basically, over 75% of the fish caught in Washington fisheries originate from Washington hatcheries. It's quite an economic value to the state, representing over $70 million in local personal income. And that was very conservative because we didn't include any of the tribal catch within the estimates that were provided. The production has really fluctuated over the decades. In the first presentation, when we talked about the historical context, we identified six phases that hatchery production has gone through since its inception. And each phase was characterized by the changes or learning that occurred in the previous years that helped change or shape the system that you see today. The contemporary production is around 175 million salmon and steelhead, but in the 80s, I think it was well over 200, I say well over, it was probably about 250 million, I think, at the high. And then the last presentation in that series covered was bringing us into to today, really, the federal ESA listings that the state has in place now pretty much throughout the state, and then the implementation of hatchery reform. Because though hatcheries do provide a large economic value to the state and a huge cultural meaning to the citizens of the state, hatchery fish also can pose a risk to the natural populations and those that are listed. So hatchery reform was really about how to reduce the biological risks that they pose while at the same time finding ways to support the economic value, fishing activities, or cultural value that exist for production. So the principles of hatchery reform, just a bit of a recap, was that hatchery programs must have clearly defined goals. Why are we producing the fish? And then when you answer that question, are you producing them for harvest? Is the hatchery production to help rebuild a population? Then you look at how you're operating the hatchery program to ensure that it's being managed or operated in a scientifically defensible manner. And then I'm getting back, the previous presentation was on performance measures, that's a bit about informed decision-making, having clearly outlined goals. When you clearly outline your goals, you also set some performance expectations. How is your program going to operate, or what are you going to use to tell yourself in subsequent years if you've been successful or not, and then what are you going to do to change it in order to ensure that you are successful, assuming that your goals were right in the first place. So in 2009, the Commission adopted the Fish and Wildlife Commission Policy 3619, and that adoption of the policy really did catalyze implementation of hatchery reform in the state. It had been underway in the state, but I think the adoption by the Commission really catalyzed that effort. And it was to advance the conservation recovery of wild salmon and steelhead by promoting and guiding the implementation of hatchery reform. The department staff were directed to use the principles and standards and recommendations of the Hatchery Scientific Review Group. We were to designate programs as conservation or harvest, and that gets at clearly defining the goals of the program. We were to externally mark all fish produced for harvest, to develop watershed-specific plans to implement hatchery reform. That reflected on the fact that each watershed is different, each population is different, and perhaps the goals within a watershed may vary by species. So it was to look, one size, it recognized one size did not fit all, and department staff needed to look on a watershed-by-watershed basis to come up with how we were going to, how the programs were currently performing and the changes that needed to make in order to ensure that they were consistent. And then we were to work toward the goal of achieving the Hatchery Scientific Review Group broodstock standards for all programs by 2015. And we were to bring the department facilities into compliance with the environmental standards of today. So in 2000, the last time we gave the presentation, we had 45% of the hatchery programs were meeting the standards. So in 2011 and 2012, the department staff focused on the Puget Sound area. There were some activities that were occurring in Puget Sound that made it a logical place to prioritize work activities. And we established the Puget Sound Hatchery Action Advisory Committee. We have two of the participants today here that will, when we're done with the presentation, I can introduce them and they'll come up and share a bit of their experience. It was nine citizens, and then we also included two Washington Hatchery Scientific Review Group advisors to really provide some technical expertise in the discussions as we had them. And we addressed salmon and steelhead in Puget Sound. The advisory committee was made up of, we have in the picture here, Lee Blankenship, who was representing the HSRG, Frank Haw, who was representing the Coastal Conservation Association, Andrew Marks, who was also with CCA, and Frank Urebeck, who was part of the Sport and Fish Advisory Group. Not pictured, but who also participated was Norman Baker with the Sierra Club, Dick Burge with the Wild Steelhead Coalition, Nick Gajewski from Wild Fish Conservancy, Clint Munns representing the Puget Sound Anglers, Michael Schmidt from Long Live the Kings, Al Senyal, who was part of the Steelhead Trout Club, and Roger Urbaniak from Puget Sound Anglers, as well as Andy Appleby, who was also representing the HSRG in a technical advisory capacity. You can see by the advisors, we had a diverse group of folks. And that really helped, I think, in the discussions that we had. Go ahead. In the our focus in Puget Sound and then actively working with the advisory group, we met monthly. Actually, we started meeting twice a month because the focus of our group was to identify population designations. We reviewed each hatchery program relative to where it was currently, to where we thought it needed to be based upon the population designations. We considered options that we could implement in order to get the programs to where they may need to be relative to where they were currently. And then the other key piece that the group helped us with was designating wild salmonid management zones. That was the key strategy outlined in the Fish and Wildlife Commission policy as well. And that was to make sure that within each you know, that within the listing, we have ESUs. Within those, you have subgroups, basically major population groupings. So we needed to have, and within each of those major population groupings, we needed to have at least one population that had no hatchery program associated with it. That was the goal behind a wild salmonid management zone. Go ahead. And Christina's going to go ahead.
So I'm going to just discuss some of the programs we've had some changes and some authorizations on. The first one was the Snake River Falls Chinook. We currently have ESA authorization through the rest of the U.S. v. Oregon agreement through 2017. And this is a recovery program. And we worked closely with our co-managers to complete the Methow Spring Chinook and Steelhead plans in the Upper Columbia. We also completed all of our segregated Mitchell Act hatchery genetic management plans for public comment, and that's closed. We're currently reviewing those with NOAA. And just in the last week, the Elwha Chinook HGMP was finalized, and the biological opinion was issued by NOAA Fisheries on that plan. We also initiated broodstock changes throughout the state in 2011 that we developed in 2010. And here's a graph that you probably saw last year. You can see it in 2010, we were at 45% compliance. The programs in green represent those that are meeting HSRG standards. Currently in 2011, we're at 61%. And those in yellow are harvest programs that still need current agreement to move forward into the green. The programs in red represent programs that are not meeting standards or that are conservation programs. Conservation programs have a main priority of returning adults to the spawning grounds and might not meet HSRG standards in the near term. And you can see that our goal is to have, by 2015, 90% of our programs in compliance, the 10% left being, we're hoping majority of them would be the recovery programs. And this is some examples of things that we've received money for. In the last biennium, some of the major projects we have in the Puget Sound under some of the hatchery improvements we're planning. And we also received 100% of our Mitchell Act funds that we applied for in the biennium. We also provided HSRG with a list of the capital projects that we had prioritized based on their criteria. And in summary, we are going to continue to have 100% of our coho and steelhead marked that are produced for harvest. Greater than 95% of our Chinook that are produced for harvest will be mass marked, and continue to make progress towards our 2015 target of broodstock management meeting HSRG goals. As I stated, we're currently at 61%, and we'll continue to bring our facilities into compliance. We have a 2030 target, and we received $40 million in the last biennium to implement broodstock management changes and upgrade facilities. And now we're going to turn it over to the Peace Shack group.
I'm happy to introduce Mr. Andy Marks and Lee Blankenship. And then, did you have questions for us, or did you want to ask? Let them speak and then ask questions? Defer.
We're still thinking here.
Okay.
So we're mulling and digesting. So let's invite, okay. Lee and Andy, good to see you.
Thank you, good morning. Appreciate this opportunity to share with you some of our experiences and talk about the process. I am Andy Marks with the Coastal Conservation Association. In late summer 2008, CCA requested a public process on the update of the Comprehensive Management Plan for Puget Sound Chinook harvest management component, which was up for renewal in 2010. In June 2009, a panel was held at NOAA's Sandpoint location to discuss that plan. And at that meeting, we were informed that there would be no public process and no opportunity for the public to review and comment on the plan submitted to NOAA. In fact, the only opportunity for review and comment would be on NOAA's review of the plan. Although a 10-year plan was requested, the plan submitted was approved for only 5 years. So it is once again up for renewal in 2015. CCA sent the commission a letter at that time objecting to the provision of the plan that included aggregation of hatchery and wild fish, which is in opposition to HSRG in the commission's policy on hatchery and fishery reform 3619. Following that, public process was created for the update of the comprehensive management plan for Puget Sound Chinook hatchery management component. Heather Bartlett headed up that process. The advisors worked collaboratively with the department and staff over a period of months to create both the process and a comprehensive work product covering Chinook and all other stocks of salmon and steelhead throughout the Puget Sound Basin. You have heard the staff report on that work product. The public process created for the plan was intensive, technical, and indeed comprehensive. Dissenting opinions were heard and recognized, and the work product represented a consensus of the advisors and staff. The advisors were invested, as was staff, and we believe the model for public process to be exemplary, achieving the goals of openness and transparency. During the hatchery plan process, it was repeatedly identified that the benchmarks identified for compliance with the department policy cannot be achieved by hatchery operation alone, and that harvest regime must be considered as a viable tool to achieve PHAS and hatchery and reduce hatchery stray rates under 3619. This is undoubtedly why you have wisely included both hatchery and fishery reform in the same policy. Failure to make progress toward achievement of those goals triggers predetermined reduction in hatchery programs with resulting loss in fishing opportunity. Although we have nothing but praise for the process and the Commission's hatchery and harvest policy, the question remains, will they facilitate wild fish recovery and optimum use of hatchery salmon? The recent release of the department's HGMP for the Green River Seuss Creek suggests not. Trucking surplus hatchery salmon to natural spawning areas in order to satisfy management objectives appears to fly in the face of HSRG recommendations and commission policy. The work product of the hatchery action group appears to have been disregarded specifically in regards to Seuss Creek Green River HGMP, which brings into question the validity and investment of the department in the public process, as well as a simple respect for the hundreds of hours invested by the advisors to participate in the process. As the hatchery action group process ended, participants requested that the hatchery advisory group be tasked to a similar process for the 2015 renewal of the harvest management component. That request resulted in the creation of a process for the harvest plan, with many of the hatchery plan advisors being asked to participate in the harvest planning process. It has been only through these advisors that the aggregation deficiency of the existing harvest plan has been discussed, as well as the imminent loss of fishing opportunity that can certainly be predicted should selective harvest not be included as a management strategy in the harvest plan component. That factor was apparently not a consideration in development of the harvest management plan update prior to being raised by the harvest group advisors.
Thank you. Lee?
Good morning, commissioners. It's a privilege to be here again and talk to you as a Hatchery Scientific Review member. As Heather said, we, two of us, Andy Appleby and myself, the chair and the vice chair of the Hatchery Scientific Review Group, participated in this review, in this what was called the Puget Sound Hack Group. And we participated just as technical or scientific advisors. We weren't part of the consensus voting or whatever. We were just there to advise on hatchery reform principles and recommendations. I'd really like to commend the department staff, and in particular Heather Bartlett, for the work that they did with the advisors and the HSRG in developing a comprehensive and collaborative product based on consensus. In my 30 years with the department and 10 years since on different advisory groups, this is what I would say the best, or one of the best, if not the best, stakeholder involvement processes that I've been involved with. One of the important work components that Heather mentioned that this group was responsible for was working out population designations for each salmon and steelhead population in Puget Sound. The population designations are really the building block of the HSRG recommendations and are called for specifically in the commission policy. Population designations express conservation goals in terms of the population's biological significance and viability. The ones we used in this process and the ones that we're using in the Columbia River, we have three terms: primary, contributing, and stabilizing. And so they describe the different levels of risk, essentially, that you're willing to take with each population. You know, so that's why they're important. Not all hatcheries are created equal, and you're willing to take more risk so you can have more harvest with populations that aren't really the core populations. So they're important. And they also provide a means of accountability and measuring progress towards your goal. And this process did a great job of doing that. It was really a consensus process that was give and take both by the department and the advisors. When Heather would say, this really isn't realistic to put this high of a expectation on this population. There's other mitigating circumstances. And so the groups would come together and come together. And so that's why it was, I termed it such a good working relationship. So now looking into the future, I'd like to comment on two things. One, it's important to take the work product of this group and move it into actual management products so that these advisors that spent hundreds of hours over a year and a half don't get disenfranchised. And in particular, I'd point to the HGMPs. It's important that you take those hatchery designations and put them in there for two reasons. One, as I mentioned, for so that the people that did all this work aren't disenfranchised. And from my perspective as an HSRG member, it gives us a way to evaluate an HGMP. If you don't have a population designation in there, we can't evaluate the actions towards reaching their goal. You just can't do it. We can't say, well, this will get you there, or this won't, or this is what you should do, or this is a great place to go. And the recent two HGMPs for Snohomish and Green River didn't have those population designations in there, and so it's really hard from our standpoint to evaluate, are they going to meet their goals? And from a stakeholder person, they think, why did we do this? So I'm just comments to think about. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, comments? I know that there must be some. Okay, I'll start. Sounds like progress. The take-home message was we're making progress. It's very nice to hear that our public involvement process was one that was satisfactory, more than satisfactory for the participants. The challenge is implementation. So an easy question for Heather then would be, you've heard the criticism of the translating the plan into action. So what is your response?
I think in the when we went through the Hatchery Action Advisory Committee work, we fully expected at that juncture that the not just the recommendations, but the designations and those parts and pieces thereof would be reflected in Hatchery Action Implementation Plans. It's a much better document for identifying that. The HGMP is a pretty this is the term that comes to my head. I don't think it's really correct, but it's a bit rudimentary for that type of, because you can't describe the context, which is exactly what Lee and Andy are getting at. So perhaps that's a function of the template, the format. Perhaps there's a way that the HGMP can be adjusted to better reflect that right out of the gate. I can't speak to that, or I'm not comfortable speaking to that on folks' behalf. I can say with the LWA, I was just double checking with Christina, in the LWA there were biological triggers included, the LWA HGMP, which I think helped in that regard.
Okay. I believe there are sections in the HGMP where we could probably express that. It gets a little bit difficult when we have, it's a co-manager agreed document, and we have negotiations with the co-managers, and we're still not quite on the same page often when we discuss those, our commission policy.
That's a good point. That reminds me. The designations are terms from the HSRG that the department has embraced. Those are not necessarily meaningful terms to the co-managers, so we try to be very careful. If we can reflect the outcome without using the term, then that's progress.
Okay. Commissioner Carpenter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to say that I'm really fulfilled to see this cooperative effort between staff, Heather, with your leadership and your staff, and then the volunteer stakeholders to work this process so well. Having been a volunteer stakeholder for a number of years in different segments, it's makes me feel real good. I have one real basic two-part question. Under your policy guidelines, there was a comment about all hatchery fish being marked. I guess I want to know, is that true? That's the first part. And those are all state-funded hatcheries, right? Right. So let's switch over to federally funded and tribal hatcheries. What percentage of those fish are not marked?
So for the question, it would be state operated hatcheries, not just state funded. For those hatcheries that the state operates, yes, those numbers are accurate. And I don't, for the federal, the same would be true. For the federal facilities, if the fish are produced for harvest, they're going to be marked. But I can't answer the numbers off the top of my head, if that's your question. I'm sure the information is
available. Are you saying it's 100% on the federal side?
If they are produced for harvest, they should be.
Okay, thank you.
Well, that was, Director Anderson, do you want to?
I mean, then there's the rest of the story.
Yeah.
The facilities, you know, that are funded by PUDs is an example. Priest Rapids is an example of that, where we don't have all the production marked, and we're continuing to try to get agreement on that, but we're frankly nowhere close to it. We have facilities like the Klickitat hatchery operated by the Akamai Indian Nation. There isn't so much I would say there isn't so much a disagreement regarding marking, but there are some logistical issues there that have prevented success in terms of marking a high proportion of that production. So there's the, whether they're U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or they're Mitchell Act hatcheries that are federally funded but operated by DFW, the statement is true, but then, you know, there are these other facilities where we don't have as high of mark rate as we do in these facilities that have been referenced.
Commissioner Mencken?
Congratulations. I think that the work that you've done collaboratively with the constituents is wonderful, and I think I'm glad to see that kind of progress. I have one question. I wasn't counting the slides as we went through them, but there was one slide that you had showing progress towards hatchery reform. That one. I must have been distracted a little bit, but I didn't get what the needing agreements meant in terms of progress or lack of progress. Can you explain to the commission a little more detail what that entails?
So most of the programs that you'd see in the yellow are either something that needs a harvest agreement with a co-manager, or it's actually what Heather was referencing, one of the hatchery action implementation plans. It was involved in that, and so we need to move forward with those documents and get agreement. So it could fall under some of the stuff that Lee was discussing about having contributing populations and then knowing what our goal would be forward in those documents.
So it has to do, at least in part, in population designations?
It can if it's a recovery program.
And can Heather, can you give me an example of the needing agreements
Sure. So the yellow includes, in particular, the yellow right now includes harvest-based programs in which either we haven't, like the coast, where we maybe haven't, we focused on Puget Sound in the last 12 to 18 months and can shift focus perhaps to the coast. So it's work yet to be done that we haven't even really initiated. And it may also represent work that we still have to reach agreement. We've captured the recommendations. It could be in Puget Sound, and we've captured the recommendations from the Puget Sound Hatchery Action Advisory Committee. Department staff are using that as a basis perhaps for discussions with their tribal co-managers, but we haven't yet reached agreement for if there's changes to be implemented, we haven't reached agreement to implement those changes that would fully bring those programs in line with the standards. Doesn't mean it won't happen. It means it hasn't happened. And so we're just trying to acknowledge that we're 50% of a relationship here. We've done our 50% and are ready to carry it forward, but we haven't. We still need the other 50.
Yes. Commissioner Jennings was next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Staying with slide 10, first off, great progress, and it's really nice. I just want to echo all the positive things that have already been said, both from a process and from an outcome perspective. A lot of progress is being made and with a lot of input. It seems like as we get that red bar smaller and smaller, it makes sense to break it into the two pieces of non-compliance for conservation reasons versus non-compliance for implementation challenges so that we can understand the distinction there. We did hear from Andy that there was some concern about the Green River Seuss Creek transplant. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit, if I understood your point properly. And I just wanted to take a moment to say what a great job, Heather, you've done for the department in this program. And the green sheet sort of says your title, but unfortunately that's no longer accurate. So,
because I've been in meetings with you now.
A great gain for some, a great loss for both the program and the agency.
So again, I've been present for a few meetings regarding that HGMP with our co-managers, and we developed a model and specifically analyzed that watershed and looked at where we've been with escapement in the last several years and where we need to be in order to implement HSRG standards. And we still don't quite have the agreement with the tribe to move forward with what we would have implemented, which would have been a stepping stone program. So we're currently going to run the status quo as we've been doing. And one of the goals that the tribe has in that area is that they'd like to see more of the adult supplementation in the river. And so that's something that they wanted to see. And so it was very kind of difficult for us to balance those two things. The document does capture it. We do have triggers. So when we do reach a certain number of natural origin spawners, we'll start implementing PHAS measurements. In that system, unfortunately, we just really haven't seen the performance to get us there. And so we're trying to just make changes. We have the hatchery itself is going to be brought up, and we're going to do a lot of renovations there. We're hoping that will help as well. So.
Commissioner Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm not a fisheries person, and this question may reflect that directly. The Hatchery Scientific Review Group are theoretically the experts on managing hatcheries, and they've developed advice to improve our hatchery management to meet our goals. At least that's the way I understand this. If that's the case, why is it taking so long for the red to disappear on that chart? Is it simply mechanical? They can't adapt to operating in the way that's best, or is there some other reason why the red doesn't disappear?
I really think that's a great question. you know, the condition of the salmon and steelhead stocks across the state, some of them are in such a depleted state that, and it's a variety of things. Hatcheries are only one of the impacts that may be deleterious on them. It could largely be habitat. So changing the hatchery program, sometimes right now, and particularly those that are in red, the objective of the hatchery program is just to keep the stock around, period, so that you have something to work with. And then once you can get perhaps some of the other perturbations that are affecting it fixed or improved, and the stock can start to do some of its own work naturally, then you can start to shift your hatchery program back in a way more towards prescriptive measures. Some examples of those would be Nooksack Spring Chinook. The population is so depleted that if you remove the hatchery program, you would have remnant numbers of fish around, and whether they would ever be able to take a hold and increase numerically, it would be anybody's guess, I suppose. The habitat is largely in a problem. So that would be a reason that the red, it's real hard. And then on top of it, you know, it's taken us 100 years to get here. It'll take us years, you know, maybe not 100, hopefully, to change it.
Thank you.
Commissioner Mencken?
Could you address for just a moment some of the problems associated with hatchery infrastructure and meeting environmental standards, which is part of this?
Sure, very good. So the hatcheries, you know, many of the hatcheries that we have today were built and designed several decades ago with the management ideas that we had at that time. We have weirs in place or intakes in place that inhibit passage perhaps upstream. That would be an environmental compliance. Intakes that the hatcheries have, we've been working on fixing those. Any culverts, there's culverts, the hatcheries, culverts are not just a hatchery specific issue, but that's another one that's part of environmental compliance, is making sure that you have adequate fish passage at varying degrees of flow for all sizes. So those are some of the environmental compliance pieces that we've been getting at. And as we become more savvy in how we manage the hatchery programs, it requires a different physical layout of your facility. And we've some of those things you can do in parts and pieces, and some of them just require a full rebuild of the facility in order to be able to do it. But that's some of the positive that Christina was referencing. The Jobs Now bill provided, you know, several millions of dollars to the department, and we already had a nice list to work from. So does that help answer, Commissioner Mencken? Is that what you were looking for?
Great. Okay, we have a couple more minutes, so I'd like to discuss a little bit the tribal perspective, and I know that there's a diversity of perspectives within the tribal communities, but that is one of the big issues before us. I know we've heard it over the years that they're not convinced that HSRG is principles are correct, or the best approach. So can you explain to us in a little bit more detail what the tribal range of views are?
I'm looking at Director Anderson. So my observations would be this, and it stems from a bit of a different value, you know, where you start, I suppose. The tribes are very interested in recovery for sure. They value the fish resource. These are what we're talking about are differences in strategies on how to be successful, I would say mostly. And they want to make sure that the state is right there with them in salmon recovery. And sometimes it's difficult for them, I suppose, to see how we will remain vested in salmon recovery if we alter our hatchery programs, mark all our fish, implement marked selective fisheries. Perhaps then we don't need to be as committed to ESA if we figured out ways to really diminish the impacts through marked selective fishery, we can have our cake and eat it too. So then where's that partnership, that commitment, that centuries, you know, or the century-long commitment that we have with them to rebuild, to, you know, fix the habitat and remain committed to some of the long, hard-term decisions. So it becomes, I suspect, a difference in strategy. And they want to also make sure that we, and I say we, the big we, the state and the tribes remain, you know, remain the owners and decision makers, per se, of the resource. We do it on behalf of the citizens of the state. They do it for their tribal members, but it's that piece of it. And so to they or we can say we've seen science, some science come and go. So it's use the science as I can quote a colleague from the Columbia River, it's a tool, not a rule. You know, so that's how they want us to view it. And so as long as we think about it that way, then perhaps there's...
Are they generally in agreement that rootstock management and percentage of natural influence are important? Or is there debate over the importance of genetics?
Well, I want to be careful how I answer that, because there is a value. I mean, they want to make sure that fish are successful at natural reproduction, but they some may not fully embrace the specifics that we may have embraced, and then we reflect in strategies in how we manage our broodstock. It's not that they want successful, but they can identify studies that suggest another strategy might be just as successful.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Mankin?
Yeah, one last comment along the same lines is recently in the Lower Columbia River during hearings on the Kitzhaber plan, Intertribe appeared before the commissioners, the three commissioners from Washington, three from Oregon, and staff. And one of their concerns was with regard to how fish are classified. And my takeaway from that was that their feeling was that a fish is a fish is a fish. And recently there was a paper published by, I think, some researchers at Umatilla. Mm-hmm. The prime author was Hess. And there have been a couple of press releases subsequent to that that says, see, we've been telling you so right along that a fish is a fish is a fish. And I guess my comment is either to Heather or to Lee with regard to the HSRG's review of or their feeling with regard to that paper published by Hess.
I'd like to comment on the Hess paper. What the HSRG felt was that the public comments, the newspaper articles that came out of the Hess paper didn't accurately reflect what was in the paper. It overblew a couple statements from the abstract that didn't necessarily align with the data in the paper. And the HSRG doesn't disagree with a lot of what was in the paper. For instance, from a broodstock management theory wasn't disagreement with a lot of the papers that were already out there. The difference was, you know, the public press said, oh, this shows that there's no difference between a hatchery fish and a wild fish if you put it back on the spawning ground. What was behind the Hess paper was what they used in the hatchery were 100% wild fish, and they only removed one generation. You wouldn't see, theory and all the other papers would say, you wouldn't see a big drop in productivity after one generation compared to a lot of our hatcheries, which are 50 generations of domestication. Big difference there. A couple other points. The paper showed that after one generation, there was a statistically significant difference in the age structure. It was lowered by those fish and the size of the fish. So in the females, there'd be less gametes. They were smaller size, so the reds might not be as deep. So those things were recognized. The other component is when they measured the success of the hatchery fish spawning on the wild fish versus how many juveniles those produced compared to wild parents mating, they only used the parents that produced adults. I mean, produced juveniles. So there were some adults that didn't produce any juveniles. So there, it was. If you really looked at the paper, it wasn't. It didn't say what the press was saying. And you, so I just a word of caution along those lines. And I'm and from one generation of 100% wild fish, you wouldn't expect a big drop in productivity. It's domestication over time that we see the loss in productivity. Just you got to look at some of the details and some of those things. In our hatcheries, we couldn't, with low productivity or low numbers of wild stock, we couldn't possibly do that in our hatcheries. There wouldn't be enough wild fish to steal from the wild to do one generation. So we couldn't have the production. It doesn't relate.
Commissioner Schmidt.
Chair, I sense we're about to close this topic. I'd just like to make a couple comments to Heather. I first met her in December. I actually remember when and where. 2005, and she and Bill Twight were introducing fishery area management plans around the state. And I saw her as such a tremendous asset in her communication skills as well as her professionalism. And that shows again today. You know, so I've watched with some excitement as her career has advanced, her move to Olympia, her change to the head of the hatchery program. And it truly is with mixed feelings. I applaud her for being willing to step out into an entire new career. That's a challenge and that's a risk. On the other side, you know, what a loss to us personally. You've done a tremendous job, and I applaud you for that.
Director Anderson?
Two thoughts. One, I would, you know, as always, caution people when they're thinking about questions about what the tribe's perspective is about an issue, you can't generalize that and say, well, the tribes think this. There's obviously, we have a lot of tribes that are involved in hatchery production and involved in wild fish recovery, and almost with every tribe, there's a little bit of a different perspective about wild fish recovery, the role of hatcheries, from an extreme where a fish is a fish to places where, frankly, we've made progress with some tribes that maybe had the perspective that a fish is a fish that now recognize, no, there is a reason to manage wild fish separately from hatchery fish and to look for ways to utilize wild fish in our hatchery systems to make them more productive, more and sustainable over time. So just caution about trying to generalize what the tribes think. We've, of course, got a lot of history about marking and selective fisheries that led to a court order that came out in 1997 that we're all familiar with, and so there's a lot of, and it also, of course, depends on where the tribe is located. If you're located where the Muckleshoots are, for example, in a highly urbanized area and extreme habitat degradation, they're looking at their hatchery systems and their wild fish in a different way than perhaps the Quileutes might. There are some marked differences in perspectives within the tribal community about how to manage hatcheries and the interactions between wild fish and hatchery fish. I don't have any mixed emotions regarding Heather like Raleigh does. It was a sad day to see Heather go. She's been I've really enjoyed working with Heather over my tenure in the department, and it's a huge loss for us. I obviously wish her well in her new endeavor, what a big loss for us. And as Commissioner Schmidt said, her professionalism, her ability to work with diverse groups and go into conflict areas and get everybody to be respectful of each other and share opinions and come to a common point at the end of those discussions is really a skill that she has. I just want to say thanks to Heather for everything that she has contributed to the fish world in the state and to the department, and we're going to miss her a lot.
Thank you. You guys are bringing tears to my eyes. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to get to come here today to do this. Yeah. So thank you.
Now, where are you going to land?
I'm in Department of Health in the Office of Drinking Water.
Great.
I mean, an example, if I may, I'm sorry to interrupt, mm-hmm. but she's here. She didn't have to be here today. She volunteered. She works for the Department of Health today, and yet here she is helping us again. So.
Okay. Well, kudos to you. Kudos to you all. But Heather, we will miss you.
Thank you. The feeling's mutual. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot.